Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, test tube babies and Android phones, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Own home, because you can download the archives every day. If you can tune in for like 5-10 minutes... Man, that guest Vinny's got on is incredibly amazing. I never heard of him, and I want to hear some more. Download the whole archive. Then you start Googling them. Then you start learning more about them. Because everybody's got a story. And some of them are just darned interesting. My very special guest today is Nick Bryant. Nick, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Vinny.
Can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
I'm a journalist. I live in New York City, and I, unfortunately, journey to the most depraved parts of the human psyche, and it's my, I guess, unfortunate destiny to be picked as one of those types of journalists that is willing to report on things that most journalists aren't willing to report on, and also willing to try to get things published that most publishers don't want to even begin to touch or contemplate the reality of.
Did you do this from a position of a professional journalist?
What's that, Vinny?
Did you do that from a position of being a professional journalist?
I am a professional journalist. I've been a professional journalist for about 20 years. And about 9 years ago, my career took an interesting turn when I decided to take on a story about child trafficking, and it's called the Franklin Scandal.
Yeah, I've heard of that. So tell us a little bit about what this Franklin Scandal was, just for those who don't know.
The Franklin Scandal is a book that I wrote, and it's about an interstate pedophile network that flew children from coast to coast and pandered them to the rich and powerful.
What kind of rich and powerful people are we? Have we got names here?
You would have to read the book, but there are some very rich and powerful people that these children were pandered to. And they, unfortunately, were taken out of orphanages and foster care homes for the kids that fell through the cracks in middle America. And the ring was ultimately immaculately covered up by the FBI and the Department of Justice in the late 80s and early 90s. And a lot of the kids were flown to Washington, D.C., and they were pandered to various power brokers in Washington, D.C.
Have you noticed that part of the FBI's job is to create the problems?
I don't know about that. I'm sure that the FBI has created a number of problems. I mean, that's been documented. But in this case, the FBI's role was to make a problem go away. And they were the heavies when it came to covering up this nationwide pedophile network.
Wasn't there a documentary that was made about this in like the late 80s, early 90s, and it was told by the U.S. government to be censored before it aired on Discovery Channel or something like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of apocrypha involved with that. There was a documentary that was made about the Franklin Scandal, and it was called Conspiracy of Silence. It was made in 1994, and it was going to be shown in the U.K. on the Discovery Channel, and for some inexplicable reason, executives at the Discovery Channel pulled the plug on it before it was finished. So it was never finished, but a rough cut of the documentary was ultimately leaked, and it's become an internet phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that was the one that I saw on it. And we had on a guy named Stu Webb yesterday, whose father-in-law was one of the personal partners and money men with George Senior Bush, you know, Poppy Bush. mm-hmm. and said that he was just a rampant pedophile. And that this kind of satanic child trafficking, horrifying, sacrificing, etc., you know, the darkest stuff you could ever see in the horror movies is where Hollywood gets their inspiration from, these people. You know, this is the reality, and I feel it is anyway. That it just really is a form of dark occult magic that these people are trying to pull off with kids.
The problem is there is certainly some ritual abuse in my book, but the majority of the abuse is just by depraved pedophiles. And that's the problem that I've encountered when I'm talking about the Franklin scandal. The Franklin scandal has percolated on the internet for a number of years, and it's been enmeshed with the Illuminati and reptilian aliens and things like that. And I spent 7 years working on the Franklin scandal, and I wanted to prove what was provable, and I wanted to also disprove a lot of the apocrypha that's boiled up around the book. And so that was my task, and I proved that there was definitely an interstate pedophile network that flew kids from coast to coast and beyond the rich and powerful, and that it was covered up by various grand juries and the FBI and Department of Justice, and actually in Washington, D.C., the Secret Service. There was some ritual. Some of the kids that did come forward did discuss ritual abuse, but the vast majority of the kids that were abused were just abused by depraved pedophiles that had nothing to do with the occult.
Were they just higher up, wealthier kind of business people, judges, lawyers, doctors, police, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the upper strata of society definitely abuse these kids, and then politicians as well. So it was basically a feeding frenzy upon the innocence of these children, and ultimately, as I said before, it was covered up. There was two grand juries in Nebraska. The ring was centered in Nebraska, and the network was centered in Nebraska. And there were two grand juries, a federal and a state grand jury, that covered it up. And in my book, I discuss a grand jury in Washington, D.C. that most likely covered it up, too. So whenever you can corrupt three grand juries to come up with a lie, it shows the kind of power that was bearing down to cover this up.
Well, two questions. Number one, who was the governor of Nebraska at the time? And number two, is there evidence that this pedophile network wasn't just coast to coast, but it was in fact part of a larger global syndicate?
The governor at the time was a Republican woman named Kay Orr. And according to my research, I don't think that she participated in this network at all. I think that there were other people within the power structure of Nebraska, very high in the power structure of Nebraska, and certainly within the Department of Justice and FBI, that may have participated in this, and they certainly participated in the cover-up. And of all the kids I've talked to, or the former victims, they discuss being flown around the country from the West Coast to the East Coast, but I've never talked to a kid that was flown out of the country. So and I've talked to a lot of victims of this network, so I would have to say that this network was domestic as far as the United States was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you heard of the Holly Greig case?
In case, yes.
In the UK, because it sounds remarkably similar.
Since I've been working on the Franklin scandal, there is the Dutroux scandal in Belgium. There's the scandal in Portugal. There's the scandal in Venezuela. There's been a scandal in Mexico. And all these have to do with large pedophile networks that pander children to the rich and powerful being covered up. So it's certainly an international phenomenon. It's just not localized to the United States of America, for sure. I want to say that I mean, every socioeconomic strata has pedophiles. But when you look at, like, the Franklin scandal, and you look at the Holly Greig scandal, and also the Dutroux scandal in Belgium, and the scandal in Portugal and Venezuela, and also in Mexico, you see that there are powerful people, and their pedophilia is actually being covered up by various authorities. And that's not the case with lower socioeconomic pedophiles. They end up on television getting busted, and but these pedophiles that I've written about, and that in these various networks that I know about internationally, no one was really arrested, or very few people were arrested. There were, you know, in a couple of them there were fall guys.
Well, think about the customer. You know, I think that the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world would also be very well traveled people. So is it possible that there's an awful lot of, you know, pedophile touristing going on?
Well, I mean, it's been documented that it certainly happens in, like, Thailand. And there was a ABC reported that there was tours of the Amazon where fairly wealthy people, fairly wealthy men would dock at various ports on the Amazon and be provided with pubescent girls. So there is definitely a precedent for type of thing. It's happened all over. It's the Roman Emperor Tiberius reportedly, you know, had sex with children and then threw them off a cliff. So the sadistic pedophiles, they've been with us for forever. And but like I said, with the Franklin scandal, you've got, and these other scandals, there's a new twist. I mean, you've got most likely blackmail, and also the state expending tremendous resources to cover these various networks up.
So is it actually the state was in part responsible for this network because of the financing of it? And I had a person on the show, I Am Not a Number One or something, and she had exposed a Dutch government basically child slavery program where they would literally rent out children to families, and they have to work for them, you know, like whether they're out there in the fields or trimming their hedges or something like that. No breaks, no pay, that kind of thing. And if they don't, if they're not happy with their job, they send them back and they charge that child for it.
I'm not familiar with that, but I have heard of instances in Europe where similar things have been done. Sweden recently went through a scandal where one of its garden hedges had been plundered. So this isn't an isolated phenomenon, fortunately. There's a lot of people in our society, and I read a study a couple of months ago that looked at Australia, and it found that the incidence of incest in Australia was 16%. So, according to that study, 16% of children are getting incested in their home. But then you've got, like, the Boy Scouts, and you've got the church, and you've got schools, and you've got a lot of places outside the home where children can be abused. So I think that the sexual abuse of children is, I don't want to sound alarmist or sound like I'm, like, witch hunt hysteria, but there is, I think that child abuse, sexual abuse, is a significant problem in contemporary society. And I think that if there's one thing, if you could eliminate just one thing in our society, and that would be sexual abuse, I think that the society would be so much better off if that one thing could be eliminated. And I know that you can't eliminate all child abuse. That would be impossible. But I think that networks like the Franklin Network, where kids were pandered from coast to coast, or I talk about the Finders in my book, too. And there was a network that was run out of Florida that was covered up in the last 5 years. So, and that was covered up by both state and federal authorities, the network out of Florida. So I think that that's one thing that people need to be edified about, is that these large networks do exist. There's never been an interstate pedophile network busted in the United States, which certainly is counterintuitive, because one would think that given the United States that there would be interstate pedophile networks, but there's never been one busted. So I wrote the Franklin scandal as kind of a template to show how pedophile networks work and how they get their children. And when people become more cognizant of it, I've had a hell of a time trying to get the book into the mainstream media, even though I think it meets the highest standards of rigorous journalism. But once people are fully cognizant of how these networks work, they'll be able to do something about them.
Exactly. You can't fight an enemy that you know nothing about. But once you know everything about them, they're very weak and virtually at your mercy. If you know how they operate, ladies and gentlemen, you can take them down. Isn't that lovely? Pretty simple, really. This is based on facts and evidence. We'll be right back with Nick Bryant at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly, deep parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls, these hangman rope sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick, trap, rob, wreck, butcher, and murder the people that keep them terrorized in gangster Frankenstein earphone radio slavery for the communist gangster government and con artist parroting puppet gangster playboy scum on top.
Welcome back.
There is no escape from this worse gangster police state using all of the deadly gangster Frankenstein controls.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on the Vinnie... on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, a show that's all about deadly, sleek, parroting puppet gangsters taking your children out of the state and you know, doing naughty, nasty things to them. My very special guest, who's an expert on such things, as it turns out, is Nick Bryant. Nick, do you have a website of some description where people can, go and see you?
Yeah, franklinscandal.com. They can visit my website, and I have got the best copy of Conspiracy of Silence on the web as far as fidelity, and also scenes that aren't in the other Conspiracy of Silences that are floating around the Internet. So people can visit my website, and I also have some documentation and a fairly good overview of the book. Although the book is 500 pages. Narrative, and then I was able to acquire sealed grand jury documentation for the book. And in the book, some of the documents that I have are just so shocking and so alarming that we felt like we had to put them in the book, just because people would have a hard time believing that they existed. We wanted to show that I wasn't conjuring these facts up out of the ether, that there were actual documents affixed to the various facts that I brought up in the book.
I love it how critical thinking is being taught to university students, right? Critical thinking used to mean something different to what it means now. Now, critical thinking is to be critical of people who are actually able to think.
Well, you know, the thing that I've discovered with the Franklin scandal is people really have a hard time accepting the book. The book's message is pretty horrific, that people abused kids for many, many years, many, many kids, and both the FBI and Department of Justice covered it up. I mean, that people have a very hard time accepting that. And the reason why I spent 7 years writing the book is I wanted to make it infallible. I mean, I really wanted to demonstrate that this did in fact happen and that it was covered up. And it was very difficult. Because of the sealed grand jury documentation, I had a list of about 60 victims. And I had to look very hard for the victims because a lot of them are very marginalized. A lot of them came from lower socioeconomic dysfunctional backgrounds, and they were either put in orphanages or foster care homes, and then at a very young age they were turned on to drugs and repeatedly molested. So that is not the ingredients of an ideal citizen that's going to be stationary for quite some time. So it was pretty laborious to find a lot of the victims, and I managed to find a lot of them. And but it was very difficult, and some of them didn't want to talk to me or refused to talk to me, and that's also very tough, too, because you can spend quite some time looking for someone, and you can, and then I would finally find them, but they weren't willing to talk to me. So there was a lot of logistical problems involved in writing the Franklin scandal. And people that were involved in the Franklin scandal saw a number of mysterious deaths also. And if you read my book, every chapter there's two or three mysterious deaths of, like, suicides, plane crashes, and things like that. And so it, and that fomented a lot of fear amongst the people that were enmeshed in this pedophile network or who had information about it. So it took a long time for people to trust me enough and then talk to me. And a lot of people are amazed that I'm still alive after writing that book. There's a lot of people in Nebraska that are quite amazed that I survived writing the Franklin scandal.
And I see that that phenomenon happening all over the place as well, you know, and I know people who are exposing pedophiles to no end in this country here in New Zealand, and exact same sort of thing. People are surprised that they're still alive, and they have had, you know, people following them and parking up outside their house, menacing and stuff like that. So he makes them a cup of tea and brings it out to their car and says, "Are you right, boys?"
I never made anyone a cup of tea, but I was followed, and I did have one overt death threat. So that kind of let me know that the story was for real. I went into this investigation with a tremendous amount of skepticism. I'm not one who's generally prone to biting on various conspiracies, and I like to research them and determine whether or not there is actual validity to them. And to me, I had written about children's issues for many years. I'd written another book previous to the Franklin scandal about lower socioeconomic children and in America and the disadvantages that they face. And I'd written a number of other pieces about lower socioeconomic children. So I was very sensitive to children's issues, and I had a really hard time believing that the government... Initially, I had a very hard time believing that the United States government or corrupt entities within the government would cover up interstate pedophile pandering. I had a really hard time believing that. And but the first time out investigating this in Nebraska, I ultimately made 13 trips to Nebraska, but the first time out to Nebraska, I did have a death threat. And I did talk to some people that were affiliated with the network who told me things that, although I wasn't really prone to believe them, they provided me with a lot of detail. And then I was able to get some documentation early on, too. So I ultimately came to the conclusion that this did, in fact, exist. And then I just had to get enough people to come forward to talk to me. And but I was able to, as I said earlier, I have scored the sealed grand jury documentation of one of the grand juries that covered it up. And in the book, I have a chapter that's just dedicated to one of the grand juries. And I show, and very seldom is a journalist able to bring a reader into a grand jury because it's illegal for them to have grand jury testimony. It's illegal for someone, a journalist, to have grand jury testimony. But I bring the reader right into a grand jury, and I show how grand juries are corrupted and co-opted, and how this particular grand jury was corrupted and co-opted. And instead of indicting the pedophiles and the abusers, this grand jury indicted the victims who wouldn't recant their abuse on perjury.
Now, does that mean to say that the reason why journalists can't have any grand jury testimony is because once they do, they'll start reporting that the grand juries have been corrupted?
Well, that's the catch with that. I don't know how the judicial system works in New Zealand, but in the United States, a fairly prominent judge in New York State once quipped that a special prosecutor of a grand jury had so much power over grand jurors that he could get them to invent a ham sandwich. And the thing about it is, a special prosecutor is chosen for a grand jury, and he's the sole arbitrator, the sole decider of what evidence the grand jurors are shown. And grand jurors are just basically good citizens that have shown up for jury duty, and they've been funneled into a grand jury. So ultimately, the special prosecutor is showing these regular citizens what evidence he deems is germane to the case. So if this special prosecutor doesn't want indictments of one person, he won't get indictments of one person. I mean, very seldom is there a runaway grand jury, because grand jurors have prosecutors have just so much power over grand juries. And it's closed to the public, too, so there isn't any reporting on it either. It's a very corrupt system in the United States, the grand jury system.
Well, in New Zealand, we have, I think, something like 80 high court justices, right, in the whole country. And something like between 45 and 60 of them are related and about first cousins. And the High Court, the Supreme Court, has 8 judges in it, 2 of which are a husband and wife. So there's a very, very huge amount of documentation in New Zealand about certain cases being covered up. There's a judge who's ruling on a financial case where the defendant is her sister, for example. You know, things like this. Another guy was sued for, I think, maybe near on $1 million. And the 3 judges presiding over him, 2 of them were former lawyers of the guy who was suing him. And he said, you know, I think there's a perceived conflict of interest there. And they go, no, there's not. Proceed. You know?
You had the same thing with the Franklin scandal. There was all the officers of the court that aided and abetted the cover-up of this pedophile network, they all became upwardly mobile. They were all bumped up in the judiciary, and which is really one of the saddest commentaries of the book, is that these officers of the court who participated in the cover-up were all bumped up the totem pole. And it's really, it shows that the American, I mean, I know that there's good judges out there in the United States that are ethical and impartial, but the Franklin scandal shows that these officers of the court who covered up these really heinous crimes were all elevated, and some of them were elevated, although the cover-up occurred during the George H.W. Bush administration, some of them were elevated during the Clinton administration. So it shows that there's some type of systemic corruption within the Department of Justice, unfortunately, of the United States of America.
It appears to me, having a look at the United States and my own country and as many other countries as I can, really, that the systemic corruption is within every single Western nation now. In every single department, you know, it seems very broad brush to say that, but it's not that well hidden in general. You can just look into it, start asking.
Well, you know,
questions.
It's interesting. In the Franklin scandal, the Department of Justice was certainly guilty of covering up this pedophile network, and the FBI was too. I mean, I've got I've got an affidavit where one of the rich pedophiles thought he was going down, so he wanted to turn state's evidence. And the FBI threatened to kill him. And the kids were all threatened by FBI agents. But here's what's kind of interesting, and this is kind of heartening. I've been investigating a pedophile network in Florida that was covered up by the Department of Justice, for sure. But the FBI in southern Florida wouldn't play. They would not play the cover-up. And they left it entirely to the Department of Justice to cover it up. So that's kind of heartening that the FBI in South Florida was completely unwilling to cover up this pedophile network.
Well, let's see how long it takes them before their chief of police dies in some horrible car accident.
Actually, the chief of police has retired because he refused to back down, at least the one in South Florida. And he took a tremendous amount of heat and ultimately retired. But there are good law enforcement officers out there. And there are also good judges. Unfortunately, there's a lot of malignant ones, too. And the malignant
ones... What kind of a ratio would we say? I mean, is it actually starting to get about 50-50, whether or not you got a good judge or a bad judge? Or is it more like 70-30, you know, you're way more likely to get a bad judge?
I just don't know. I don't know. And I do know, I mean, and I've seen this with the Franklin scandal... People that are compromised, generally, at least the politicians that I believe that are compromised, they generally vote with their constituency, what their constituency wants them to vote. But occasionally markers are called in and they are told how to vote. That's generally against what their constituency, would like. They're generally allowed to vote and operate the way that they usually would, except when certain markers are called in. And I think that might be the case with judges, too.
Or with the President of the United States, for example.
Or perhaps the President of the United States. I don't know about that.
Well... I'm not saying he's a pedophile. I'm just saying, you know, it's the same kind of behavior that we see throughout a lot of our big departments and public officials. You know, they'll say one thing and they'll do another. And
it's difficult to know. I mean, the thing about the Franklin scandal is it's difficult to know. I mean, are people corrupt because they're being greased by the pack, or are they corrupt because they're compromised? There's pictures of them. That's the question.
I think they might be corrupt because the world of work actually dictates that if they set up their competition to fail and get them fired, they'll produce themselves forward and actually advance through the ranks by taking out the competition rather than competing fairly. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the psychopathic 2 hours of talk radio. We'll be back in a moment.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. with the Fukushima radiation, where everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. Yes, indeedy. Nick Bryant is my very special guest. And the final question that we usually have for our guests when we got them on the show is, if there is anything that you, well, let me put it a different way. We all self-censor, and if there's anything you thought might have been too risque, or it didn't come up in the conversation at a particular point, or maybe you didn't say it because it could be a bit controversial, here's kind of the place to say it. So if you have anything, you know, fire away.
Well, anytime that you say that the United States government is covering up pedophile networks, I mean, I don't really think you can get more controversial than that. I didn't talk about the D.C., the Washington, D.C. chapter too much in our interview. And in the Washington, D.C. chapter, I discussed there were two pedophilic pimps who managed this network, and one was in Omaha, Nebraska. His name was Lawrence C. King, and the other one was in Washington, D.C. His name was Craig Spence. Now, Craig Spence was a power broker, a power broker's power broker. He had tremendous connections. It was like he knew everyone in the Congress, and also had great connections to the Reagan and Bush administrations. It was like he had a direct line to Mount Olympus. And a lot of the pedophilic parties would go down in his very nice mansion. And in the book, I prove that his mansion was wired for audiovisual blackmail. And a lot of the politicians that partied there and molested children there were ultimately compromised. And with Craig Spence, he would provide you with children, but if you wanted young men or young women, he would provide you with them, too. I mean, we're talking like 18 or 19 or 20. He spent $20,000 a month at an escort service. And I was the first guy and only guy to get that, the guy who ran the escort service where he spent $20,000 a month to talk. And that was one of the coups that I was able to, one of many coups that I was able to succeed at when I was writing the Franklin scandal. And we omitted Boys Town. Boys Town in Nebraska is probably the most the famous orphanage in the world. I mean, there's been a number of movies made about, I believe three movies made about Boys Town. And a number of the kids that were victims in this pedophile network were actually gotten from Boys Town. And I've interviewed Boys Town kids that were molested by this network and molested by, or allegedly molested by, who work at Boys Town. And Boys Town has never overtly paid out a single penny for any child molestation. And when people read my book, they will see that Boys Town, although it has helped a lot of children, the dark side of Boys Town is very, very dark.
Well, how dark? What are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about kids being flown around the country and pandered. And we're talking, one of the victims who I interviewed for the Franklin scandal told me that he arrived at Boys Town at 12, and he was flown around till he was like 15, repeatedly molested. And at one point, he was subjected to very sadistic pedophiles. And at one point, he said that he told someone in Boys Town administration that he could no longer take part in these parties because they were just too sadistic. He just couldn't handle it. And then he said that the next day he was flown from Omaha, Nebraska, and deposited in a mental institution on the outskirts of Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, now this seemed so fantastic that I didn't believe him. I really had a hard time believing that he'd be flown from Omaha, Nebraska, and deposited in a mental institution and outside of Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, I just I was very skeptical of it. And actually, I told him that I was very skeptical of his account. And we were talking about good feds and bad feds earlier. Well, I did, throughout my seven-year investigation of the Franklin scandal, I did come across some good feds, and they actually corroborated that, that he was actually flown from Omaha, Nebraska, and deposited in a mental institution outside of Atlanta, Georgia. These feds corroborated that story for me. So, needless to say, I went back to him and said, you know, your story has been corroborated, and I'm very, very sorry that I was so skeptical.
Well, there was another person that I had on the show, a couple of them that said that Atlanta was known as a hot spot for human trafficking.
There's a lot of hot spots for human trafficking. The thing about it is, and this is truly unfortunate, child trafficking, human trafficking, everybody thinks it's a bad thing. Everybody thinks human trafficking is a bad thing. Everybody's down on child trafficking. But unfortunately, they look at it from 25,000 feet. And with the Franklin scandal, I bring people face-to-face with child trafficking. You're no longer looking at it from 25,000 feet. You're face-to-face with child trafficking. And a lot of people have a hard time with that. But as long as you've got a lot of naive people that are trying to study child trafficking, and then you've got a lot of corruption within law enforcement. So it's really difficult to know the hot spots of child trafficking and human trafficking. It wouldn't surprise me that Atlanta is the hub just because of the sheer volume of people that live in the Atlanta area. And that it's such a busy airport. I think the Atlanta airport is the busiest airport in the United States of America at this point. So it wouldn't surprise me that it would be a hub for human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Well, how exactly are we supposed to expose and take this kind of thing out of the picture if the emotional trauma that people suffer just by going into it, if you have any empathy at all, and you look upon these topics and you really research into them, it breaks your heart. It really does hurt you in a very significant way. I just feel
well,
that
you know, the thing about it is, it ultimately comes down to, do you want to eradicate it or not? You've got to bite the bullet. With the Franklin scandal, I diagnose a disease in the society. I mean, the diagnosis is there. With the Franklin scandal, I mean there are pedophile networks that the Franklin scandal is basically a template for. In the Franklin scandal, I show how predators move children. I show how they acquire children. I show what they do with children, and then I show how they're covered up, how their crimes are covered up. I mean, so there isn't a facet of child trafficking that is not addressed by my book. Now it's up to people to read it and understand it. And the pedophile network that was covered up in South Florida, I mean, if people were cognizant of the Franklin scandal, the Department of Justice wouldn't have been able to have covered up that pedophile network in Florida. So people are just going to have to bite the bullet and get conscious of these types of things. And it's a horrific, it's horrific, but if people say, well, it's just too horrific, I don't want to deal with it, then basically you're signing off on it. For the perpetuation of it. I mean, it's up to your listeners to decide whether they want to sign off on it or they want to do something about it.
I think that's a really important point that you've touched on there. It's like, you never accomplish anything great unless you suffer just a little bit, because it makes you stronger. It wills you and spurs you on. You make better things by going through bad things, okay? It's what makes us who we are. And what I think is the problem with our generations today is that they read between the lines so much, they miss the lines themselves and don't even react when they're crossed anymore. You know, it's like they don't care.
Well, the great philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And a lesser philosopher by the name of Nick Bryant said, what doesn't kill you hurts like hell.
Yeah. And I think both statements are true. Nick Bryant, philosopher, author, and investigative person who's willing to spend a lot of gas money walking around to find people to interview for his book.
40,000 miles.
Oh my God! What is that, like, coast to coast, like 11 times?
it was quite a laborious undertaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chinese say, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and you began it with putting the pedal to the metal until your gas tank went dry.
Well, it was good talking to you, Vinny. Have yourself a great night.
Thanks, Nick. All right. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up after the break, we'll have Joe Carolyn talking about the privatisation of New Zealand's wharves for international scumbaggery. Back in a minute. Gentlemen, it is hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from Auckland, a place where Agenda 21 is going strong. And I just kind of wanted to do a little bit of an outline for people. The caller lines are now open. The number is 218-339-8525. 218-339-8525, because I think you'll probably be able to relate to this. The ports of Auckland, biggest, most successful port, like, and it's part of the world practically, has decided that they'll just straight up sack 300 union employees and ask them to reapply for their jobs. Everybody's up in arms. You know, they're saying, oh, well, you know, kicking out the workers, they don't care about our rights or anything, it's about power. It's, well, yeah, that's true, but it's part of a wider scheme. Privatisation is fascism. I've said this many times. That's the definition of it, using public-private partnerships to wither away the size of the state until eventually people are no longer citizens. They're just partners in the corporation with just as few rights. That's precisely what is happening here. Taking out people who have set work schedules. If you are like on call, for example, if anybody's ever been in a medical ward or what have you, and you're on call, you basically, your life is on hold at any given time. That's the beauty of it. You become sleep deprived. You get taken away from your family, and you wind up doing a bloody hard job, and that kind of thing shouldn't be an everyday thing for people in general. You know, you need to have set work schedules and things of that nature if you're in a job per se, depending on it, and what the people at the wharf are saying is that that's just inefficient. You know, it's terrible. We're just going to have private contractors come in at our whim and we can fire them whenever we want and they got no rights. You know, hello. Same thing happening to all the other council operations. Doesn't matter whether it's trash pickup or railway lines or anything. Who owns them all now? Who's running them all now? Who's paying them? It's Veolia. World's largest water multinational, allegedly Rothschild-owned, That's right. That's what they do. They come in and they take over all your public services. Everything that actually creates money in your economy, they want it. They will sell it out to corporations that they own, and they will continue to control them and profit off them no matter the size of the country. It doesn't matter. Wherever you are, this is going on, and you'll see it. You'll see it everywhere you look, once you start looking for it, of course. Now, the question that some people ask is like, oh, why would they do all this? You know, how would this be accomplished? It just sounds fantastic to me. You know, I'm skeptical about it. Well, have a look at how much money is being spent on private contractors. United States studies have revealed that if they had in-house services, you know, state-owned enterprises or whatever, running things like maintenance, upkeep, things of a infrastructure-related thing that always need to be upkept all the time, in-house services wind up being about half that of contracted-out services. So that's why the contractors can make a bajillion amounts of money relatively easily too, and consistently. They can have contracts that last for years, and they'll keep consistently raking in the cash during that entire period of time. That is the game plan, because there's no such thing as partial privatization. It's like partial pregnancy. There's just no such blimmin' thing. It's pretty straightforward. If it makes money, and it makes money for the region and for the people, and it's owned and run by the people, and benefits them directly, they will contract it out, make it twice as expensive, and run the people dry. Okay? It happens everywhere you look. Doesn't matter whether it's Ports of Auckland, doesn't matter whether it's Mighty River Power, or any other number of things, you know. Trans-Texas Corridor is a perfect example of this. Taking pre-existing roads and then signing a contract to a Spanish roading company for a 50-year contract to collect tolls on those roads, even if they get more money off the tolling than the original contract cost. And they'll keep consistently doing that. Okay? It's about charging you money as soon as you step out your door. You know how the Auckland City Council is planning to do all these new roads and infrastructure projects, rail loops, etc.? They're going to increase people's taxes. They're going to suck the money out of you. They're also going to toll existing roads. They're also going to install smart meters and start charging people more for their power. They're going to start doing a whole range of things. They're going to start making you pay for your trash pickup. They're already doing it in many places. In fact, almost the entire thing. Make you pay for a pickup of your recycling. Make you pay to park outside your own home. Give you tickets if you're parked outside your own home and you don't have like a valid warrant of registration. It doesn't matter how far away you are from the city. And this happens all the time. You see it everywhere. They're milking us. Milking us like we were some brutish cow with very, very little concern for the justice of things. Okay? Say someone's parked on the side of the road, someone's using the road, whatever. Have they hurt anybody? No. Have they done any undue damage to the road? No. Okay. Well, where's the justification for giving them a fine or a speeding ticket or a speed camera thingy, you know? And these things are all over the place. You can't step outside your door without being at risk of being fined at any time. It's unbelievable. Where do these people come up with it? Well, where's the justification for it? You know, registering your car. You know, you have to do it all the time, and it costs a decent chunk of change. And so what do they do when they say that, our accident compensation fund isn't making enough money? Let's charge people extra. Hold on a sec, mate. Didn't the actual analysis reveal that they made $10 million profit? Yeah, but we're going to charge you extra anyway. They just sell you a lie, tell you that it's going to make everything all right, make you pay out through the nose, and then later on sell you another lie, which will make you pay out through the nose again. happens even with these government saving programs. We had this interesting program here in New Zealand called KiwiSaver. And they said that, well, what we're going to do is we're going to salvage some of your money. We're going to, you know, take a bit of money out of your paycheck, about 4% or whatever, and put it into this bank account that we're opening for you. It's your KiwiSaver scheme. And your employer also has to put about 4% into there. And the government puts like 4 cents in there or whatever. So you wind up saving 12 cents out of every dollar, 8 cents that wasn't even there in the first place. And it all goes into this big scheme. Who is entrusted with your money? Oh, well, it turns out that they're all investment schemes with major finance houses. And then, in the New Zealand news, you have a look at all these finance companies. And what happened to them? Something like 18, 19, goodness knows how many of them collapsed inside of a couple of years. It's because they're bought up in all this derivatives crapola. That's what they're doing with your savings money. They're taking it, turning it into derivatives, and turning it into just paper money that doesn't even worth anything. So for the moment when you go to get it out, like 10, 12 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, or whatever, and you can't get it really until you retire, and maybe if you want to buy a house, they'll give you a couple of grand out of it or something, you know, these people are just going to take your money from you. And that's why I didn't put any, you know, money in that kind of scheme. After all, why would you ever want to put money into something that is actually called a scheme? Don't you think they've got schemes in the works? It's a kind of a dead giveaway. I feel that this whole system, and it is a systemic problem. I'm talking about just specific New Zealand case studies here. There's the same stuff everywhere else, you know. Social Security in the United States, boom. What happened? It got stolen. 401k plans, stolen. Take them by all these Wall Street bankers and the ultimate criminality scumbaggery, right? They have no concern whatsoever for your economic well-being in the least, okay? Watching Bloomberg this morning, and they're talking about how the economy's starting to turn round, and we did these stress tests on the bank, and 15 out of 19 major banks passed the stress test. What was the parameters of the stress test? Oh, yeah, that's right. If there was, like, a recession in Europe or something like that, as opposed to if the euro dollar gets scrapped, or there's a major economic depression, or a major war, or anything else. All these major parameters that actually would seem to be, according to many people, very likely to happen, don't even factor into their equations. So naturally, they'll just see this very minutiae statistical possibility as a good sign and tell everybody, keep investing your money, keep putting it into all these massive finance companies and things like that, keep letting us make it all into massive derivative debt, keep borrowing money from the Federal Reserve Bank at 0% interest. It's great, it's great, it's boom times. Are you freaking out of your minds? How can anybody believe this twosh, this twaddle, this scumbaggery majestic magic? It's just out of control. These people are insane. They're completely, completely out of touch with reality. They haven't done a day's work in their fracking lives. Sit around BSing people and shilling crappy information for a living? You've got to be fracking kidding me. How can this continue? It can't, is the answer. And eventually, people are going to be out there with signs saying, jump, you frackers. And there's a reason for that. Because people don't like being lied to. They don't like stuff being stolen off them. But of course, if that's just the only thing that's bringing them together, oh, I don't like this, I don't like that, I don't, and there's no serious discussion about what the root cause of the problem is, and there's no real serious form of leadership or direction in the movement, I've got to refer to Occupy Wall Street here, then basically it's just going to be broken up and taken down and marginalized by the people who are more well-organized. You know, the police, the media, all of the politicians, everything like that, they're all very well-organized. They can ignore you, they can shut you down, they can throw you in prison, they can do all these things. And if you're not as organized as they are, they're just going to eventually wear you away to nothingness, as happened here in Auckland, New Zealand. Occupy was just simply disbanded after a few bits of paper were issued saying that what they were doing was illegal. And then the cops came in and mopped up the remainders, and now they're in court. And they got to pay like some, and the council had paid nearly $200,000 in fees to one law firm just for the legal bills. And the total bill in itself, with all the damage they caused, blah, 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 grass, this, that, private security, private investigators, private this, private that. And it's like a total of $300,000, and one lawyer gets about $200K of that. Well, am I missing something here? What exactly is so difficult and expensive about pushing a few fracking pens around or reading a few documents? It's not that kind of expense that you're talking about. You're just talking about somebody who's allegedly got some kind of great reputation, won't let you down, won't fail, will get the result you want, etc. And you're just paying through the nose for it. You know, even if they do a minimal amount of work, they still charge you for every tiny little second that they do. Every kind of scumbaggery imaginable is involved in the takeover of our nations. Let's just be clear. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about corporate scumbaggery, government scumbaggery, or just general public scumbaggery, or the people from the grassroots level who have grown up in the system, who don't have any respect for their elders, who want to go around vandalizing stuff and what have you, and just basically wreaking general havoc. You know, there's nothing wrong with it as long as nobody gets hurt, allegedly. But that kind of disrespect or whatever, instead of having fun by being creative, making things with your friends, etc. Hey, they're just a product of the system. And that kind of behavior will vanish as quickly as the system does. You know, that's why corporate responsibility is dead in America. It's because the system does not advocate that kind of thing. It advocates getting the biggest profits. And you know what the most profitable industry of all is? Theft. You know why? Because you don't have to pay for the products before you hawk them off to unsuspecting buyers. That's what's going on in this country. It's what's going on in every other. Theft. Wholesale, cataclysmic quantities of it that have no justification, no sanity, only scumbaggery. I can very much easily sum it up just like that. Thank you very much. Soundbite it, upload it to YouTube. Well, bam, it's all G-Unit. And the same type of crap that we talk about coming out of the finance institutes are also coming out of our local governments and our politicians' mouths. It's because they're all operating under this global to local program. Yes, we want one world government. Yes, we want to take away everybody's rights. Yes, we want to make sure everything is absolutely destroyed and nobody can have any form of self-sufficiency. Yes, total control. Total control forever. What are you doing, mate? You're a creepy mofo. Get out of here. You know, it's an appropriate response, I think. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Caller lines are open. You can call in 218-339-8525. I'll say that again, 218-339-8525. Call on in. We'll be right back.
Elevator music that we play in Parliament here in New Zealand, because it's all about the Godfather Mafia up in here. Broadcasting live on the American Freedom Radio Network, one of the most fabulous little networks that simply refuses to die. So we just torture it a little bit. with terrible gangster-licious bankster scumbaggery on the Vinny Eastwood show.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Godfather.
You're welcome.
Now, speaking of gangsterish scumbaggery, there is, I feel, quite the finger to be pointed at the US and Israel relationship at this point. And Israel says, oh, we're going to go and attack Iran, you know, with their uber sinister, prime sinister, Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, it just goes to show you the American public will just bow to it. Just any old Yahoo, let alone Netanyahu. This guy is unbelievable. Barack Obama, Nicolas Sarkozy, secretly they hate him. You know, the little tapes come out and they just go, oh my God, this Yahoo guy. Oh, goodness sake, he's just insane. He's out of his mind. And then, of course, they capitulate and go, yep, sweet ass, we'll do whatever this insane fracker tells us to do. oh my goodness. Hey, Iran, yeah? Well, you know how you haven't attacked anybody in like 300 years, right? Yeah. Well, how about we just, you know, say that you're suddenly aggressive all of a sudden for no reason, and that you're actually trying to manufacture nuclear power in order to get nuclear weapons out of it. You go, yeah. Well, if we are doing that, so what of it? You know, you've got nuclear weapons to defend yourself. Why can't we have them? Wouldn't it be a good deterrent from some big, scary, horrifying, insane tyrant trying to, you know, threaten us or whatever? It was like, mate, you don't know who you're dealing with here. You know, we don't want to use these things at all. That's why most countries that do have them have a fair few of them and never use them. You know, what do you think the Russians have done with like umpteen thousands of nuclear warheads? Nothing. Sitting there rotting away. There's no point having these weapons. They're incredibly expensive and you never use them. You know, it's just you want to make sure that your enemy knows you've got them so that they don't try anything. You know, it's very much the simple principle of self-defense, I feel. If you've got a deterrent, it'll be much easier for an attacker to be availed. Happens all the time. The United States, you know, a lot of people are carrying around concealed carry with permits and all that kind of stuff. Gang of 20 youths comes at them saying, I'm going to kill you. They show them the business end of a revolver. And they let them go and nothing happens to them. Because all that person has to know is that you are not a victim. You can fight back if you choose to try and predate on them. That's all that nuclear weapons, I feel, are good for at the end of the day. Everything else that they do is pretty fracking awful. You know? Imagine being in Hiroshima or Nagasaki and just all of a sudden there's this big flash and you just watch everything turn to dust in front of you. Every person you've ever seen, every street that you've ever walked down, every building that you've ever been in, every tree that you've ever swung from a tire on, everything just gone. That is the kind of thing that you don't want to see happen. And if you don't want to see it happen to you, you wouldn't want to see it happen to anybody else either, would you? Unless they were trying to kill all of you, do the exact same thing, isn't it? I think that's basically what people need to understand about this. It doesn't matter if other countries have nuclear weapons or anything like that. Iran has always been very anti-terrorist, just like Iraq was. In fact, these nations have only recently started to experience terrorist activity because of the presence of the US. Because all these people just suddenly come out of the woodwork. Ah, there's Americans, there's the infidels, let's go get them. And a whole bunch of dumb, innocent young Arab men get recruited by these psychopathic, completely insane people who are manipulating the words of the Quran to try and get some kind of righteous indignation out of their fight of just causing terror and pain and havoc and stupidity. You know, exact same protocol that the US soldiers follow, except they have a different uniform and they take a different pledge, which they don't follow either. because they're supposed to protect the US from enemies, foreign and domestic. And you think if they've been actually doing their proper job, that any of these domestic terrorists, like the Bush, Cheney, Papa Bush kind of criminalized satanic, etc., weapons manufacturing, finance house controlling crime syndicates. Do you think any of them would be getting away with all of the stuff that they're doing to everybody on a day-to-day basis if there was anybody out there in the US military taking their oath fracking seriously enough? You know, it's been bred out of you. It's like this psychological castration, I've called it. This is what's happening to everybody. Their will has been broken. Their patriotism destroyed, the country undermined, all the resources, all the wonderful things that the frontier once had and possessed is now owned by foreigners. Isn't that just the saddest thing? And it's wholly owned. Have a look at all the amounts of debt. Where's all that debt owed to? Private banks, the scumbaggery filth who just made that debt up with the flick of a pen. And suddenly they own all of you because they allowed you to get into that much debt that in order to pay it back, they could literally seize your entire country, everything, down to the last citizen as a piece of stock, livestock, on a global plantation. That's essentially what they're now, you know, legally able to do, in my opinion, because they own all the judges. They own the international criminal courts. You know, all the places you would think to look. All those rises of officialdom have all failed to prevent themselves from being corrupted by this international criminal cartel. They failed. There's nowhere to go for help. And the best solution to the biggest problems is always the smallest and simplest solution for whoever is in that position at the time. Okay, it's pretty straightforward. If there is some kind of privatization going on in your country, you recognize it, then the onus is on you and you alone, the person who realizes it, to go out there and try and change something, try and get some public attention, call a meeting, run for the office, or even just to use the podium to criticize your opponents and show the public how they're lying to everybody, how they don't care about what you really want, how they are owned by foreign interests and they are merely puppets, that this is a show that is going on to distract everybody from knowing the truth, that you are being harvested just like a cornfield. You are being stripped, you are being cut, and you are being sold off to market. No different to a herd of cattle. That's what they think of us. We're just profit to be extracted to them. They ain't got no empathy. You think if they did, they'd collapse the economies at will? Start wars for no reason? You know, think about the mindset. If you can know what your enemy's thinking or know how they think, that's the best step going forward to figuring out how to defeat them, how to trick them, how to deceive them. Because all war is deception. It's all it is. And the truth is usually the first casualty of it. Once you go to war, all bets are off. You know, there won't be... I can just see this now that I'm thinking about it. Once there is a war with Iran, and the alternative media has been saying that there's going to be one for ages, and it's going to be by hook or by crook, you know, if the Iranians are stupid enough to fire first, which they won't be. And if they don't, then the US will probably just set something up, you know, some kind of false flag. They always do. And then, boom, we're at war. And now all the alternative press will start to, you know, be hated by the general populace. You know, you remember at Iraq, when we first went into Iraq to criticize it and what have you, it was an incredibly popular movement, but the war was just so widely advertised on the media, and the anti-war movement just got, you know, pitiful coverage. Okay, same thing's going to happen again. And the brainwashed masses are just going to go pouring forth to the recruitment officers, and they'll start going to meetings all of a sudden, and they'll start saying that we care about the troops, let's send them over to kill people and die or get wounded and come back and be horribly disfigured or terribly disabled for the rest of their existence. Let's do that. Let's support the troops by doing that. The naivety. It's as if 100 years of war footage and things like that. Have you ever seen a happy, lovely, kind, decent, wonderful war movie? It was just, oh, it was so beautiful how they got shot and their brains sprayed all over their friend. And he wet himself and he was so terrified. It was just a thrill to watch. Come on. War is hell. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing, as the song says. It's pretty straightforward. You don't want to go there. I don't understand anybody who even want to join the military. I don't understand it. I mean, you might have skills that are incredibly valuable to the military, but the problem is your military in a decent part of it, I mean, I'm sure there are probably legitimate operations that go on, you know. I'm not sure if peacekeeping qualifies. I don't know. I honestly don't know what the military is good for, apart from, as I mentioned earlier, acting as a deterrent to those who would aggress you. Because often, they will simply try to pick on a weaker neighbour that they think they can take. We can take them for all they're worth. That bit of land right there is a good position for us to set up an operation to control the entire Middle East. That's why the US built like 50 giant permanent bases in Iraq. It's all right there. Just waiting for something. With a huge amount of military forces there that you wouldn't believe. Now, you ever seen those pictures of the row upon row upon row of attack helicopters and tanks and APCs and all this armaments and stuff like that? Man, that stuff's expensive. Where the hell they get all the money? It's unbelievable. It's beyond the mind reels. The huge expense that they put it there, and for what? You know. Somebody's obviously got an interest in that part of the world, and by the looks of it, a very strong military interest. What starts happening in the media? Oh, we're prepping for war again. Just as all these bases are due to be finished and built, no doubt. Well, you know, it's have you ever played the game of Risk? You know, once you conquer a territory, you mass your troops in there, and then you go and conquer another one. Except this time, they're playing with dynamite. They're playing with fire. They're playing with nukes. Russia, China, India will quite likely vigorously defend Iran's interests because they get decent oil from them. Russia's afraid of any more further encroachment on its territory or surrounding territories by US military. You know, they've already got them surrounded pretty much. EU's on side, US military bases all over the place, US military bases all through the Middle East or the Russia-South border, you know, and not to mention there's Alaska, so they can attack from that way as well. Okay, come on. This is what military stratagem and geopolitics is really all about. Thinking about how to make some kind of a world war situation so that you can demolish the world and kill off a whole huge quantity of people so that you can basically build up from what's left out of the chaos that you've just created. You know, order ab chao. Order out of chaos. Best way to start a new society, destroy the existing one and just ruthlessly expand your own one. Isn't that about right? That sounds exactly like the thinking of a psychopathic individual to me. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. No, I'm not bloody wrong. Anybody out there has got any point of naivety about this kind of thing? It's as simple as denying whether or not powerful people who have a lot of influence actually use their power to gain more power and influence. If you think the answer to that question is yes, then you're a conspiracy theorist. You're a tinfoil hat-wearing, organic food-eating, dreadlocked, army pants-wearing conspiracy theorist. Unwashed and very crazy and smoking too much drugs. That's you. You're a conspiracy theorist if you think that powerful people use their power. Okay? That's the naivety of it. And people at best wake up. And you can't just be awoken. What do you do after you wake up? You have to get out of bed. You know, nobody can force you to get out of bed. You got to do it yourself. And then you got to go to work. And you got to start researching everything. Okay? That's the wake up process. Somebody else might open your eyes, but it's you that eventually has to decide whether or not you need the cold bucket of water tipped over you before you get out of bed and do something about it. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, and we'll be right back in a few minutes. Please don't desert me.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. I'll do a dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. I have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the remote but not isolated island change nation of New Zealand, from the fluoridated capital of Auckland. And my very special guest has arrived, Joe Carolyn. Joe, welcome to the program, bro.
Vinnie, I have done that bastard of a flight from Europe, 35 hours stopovers in Tokyo or whatever. Man, this is a hard country to get to.
Yeah, it's a pain. It's a pain, isn't it? And I think that's why people think that they're safe down here from corporate tyranny and whatnot. But they're wrong. Oh, they're very wrong.
No, we are being colonized again.
Let's talk about the Wolfie situation. I mean, I don't think a lot of people actually really get to hear any kind of first-hand experience or what have you of it, because, well, mainstream media just, you know, says their comments and takes the comments of a few protesters and magnifies it.
Sure, yeah. And the Wharfies, as they're called in New Zealand, are called dockers in most other countries. Longshoremen or longshore workers, watersiders over in the States. These are the guys who are on the waterfront. If we've all seen that Marlon Brando film, and it's a hard job, it's a dangerous job, it's a skill job, you need to know what you're doing. And over the years, in many, many countries, the workers who've done this hard labor have fought hard to unionize and protect their conditions, protect their safety, and that's why they're strong, because these jobs, just like mining, construction, you know, this is hard hat, working class, blue collar labor, that needed to stand up for itself and fought hard to get good conditions for the working class. Now we can see these guys are at the front line by a government here who wants to smash workers' conditions, get us all down to third world labor rates and conditions, contract out our jobs, and in the end try and steal the ports from the people, privatize it and sell it to their rich mates.
Yeah. I was talking about this earlier on in the show as well. It's just part of what's happening globally, and basically these people who are they own our governments now, so they don't really care. They'll just come in and take it or do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the government is only an executive elected by these kind of multinationals, you know. And if you look at the guy who's running the ports, this guy, Tony Gibson, you know, he pays himself twice as much as the Prime Minister of New Zealand. He's on $700,000 a year. Many of the other people who are down on those on the board of directors down there, you know, get paid a spectacular amount of money for attending 10 or 12 meetings a year. Yet these are the people who lecture the workers about being lazy, who try and make it a crime nearly in the media that workers have a, have an average wage or a reasonable wage, you know? Now, what's
well, they've actually,
about this,
they've made it a crime to even strike, haven't they? That's what I saw.
Well, it's not a crime to strike in New Zealand. It, you know, I mean, and when people have the right to strike here during bargaining, you know, when there's a new collective, you know, it's illegal for workers to be sacked or victimized, because the difference between a worker and a slave is that a worker can refuse to do work. Right? A slave can't. A slave can be whipped and punished and killed, but a worker can't. And indeed, any of the rights that workers have here in New Zealand or in America or in other countries are rights that weren't given to us from on high, but were fought hard for. You know, things like the weekend, things like overtime pay, things like sick pay, you know, or grandparents and her parents, you know, fought for these things, fought hard. But yes, like you say, it's part of an international attack by the 1%, by the wealthy elite, to take these things off us and actually to bring in a 21st century form of slavery where people won't have regular hours or guaranteed hours. They will have completely casualized hours where the bosses can decide, you have no hours today, you have a two-hour shift today, you have a 16-hour shift today. You just wait at home, chained to your phone, and when we pull on your leash, slave, you come to work when we say so.
I mean, it's basically trying to turn each and every person into sort of like a dock working Superman. Like all of a sudden he gets the call and he's into the phone box and he's into his overalls and he's over there.
And it will destroy family life. I mean, what I think is very, very hypocritical of a lot of these right-wing guys is they pretend that they're church-going people with family values who support the family, blah, blah, blah. Yet when it comes to the working class, these are the people who, by reducing the hours of work per week, steal food from working mothers who need to feed their kids. Like, that's what I do. I organize workers in McDonald's here in New Zealand. When the store franchisees cut a worker's hours from 25 or 30 hours down to 18 or 12, which happens regularly, I know that it's not just, you know, pin money, you know, that these workers want to spend on the new Britney Spears record or something, you know. I mean, these are low-paid workers who need these jobs because there isn't many other jobs there. And they've got kids to feed. And when they get their hours cut, that means kids go hungry, right? And it's going to be the same now for these wharfies, you know.
And the
it's
wharfies,
going to be the same, actually, for everybody. It's going to be the same for everybody because just as Maggie Thatcher in the 80s needed to smash the strong unions like the miners before she completely wiped out all the weaker ones, then so it is here in New Zealand now. The wharfies are one of our strongest organized workforces with a proud tradition going back to the 50s when they faced near fascism, where it was illegal to feed the wharfies who were locked out for 150 days. It was illegal to read any of their leaflets. Their newspaper was closed down. Their union was closed down. All their assets was confiscated, stolen by the government. And that's how they broke them in the 50s.
Well, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. I think it might have been Mark Twain that said that. And what we have here is the same old world kind of gilded age people trying to come up with a gilded cage for the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and certainly, I mean, if you look at the contrast between and the working class, both here or in America, and those who are at the very, very, very top, you know, it's gone beyond hypocrisy. You know, it's gone beyond, you know, disdain. It's coming up to times where we need to actually organize a serious revolt to put manners in these people. One thing we're arguing for here in Auckland is that there are so many people now getting crap from this government. Not only the wharfies, we've got all our meat workers locked out of their plants here in New Zealand. You know, another hard working class job is not a pleasant job, working in the slaughterhouse. We got our state tenants being kicked out of their houses. These were working class people who were offered these houses after World War II. They went out and fought against fascism. And the deal made with them was that when they came home, they would build houses fit for soldiers. And now their families have been kicked out so property developers can come in and move their land. We got our students, you know. University is now a place where working people can't afford to go to. It's becoming, as it was 100 years ago, a place where only the wealthy can afford to go to. So many things under attack. What we're all arguing for is that stop everybody fighting in your individual little single-issue campaigns. Let's get together. Let's unite. And you saw that last Saturday down at the wharfs here in Auckland, where it wasn't just the wharfies out on their own getting vilified by the media and attacked by the police. They were joined by the firefighters here. They were joined by the meat workers. They were joined by the GI tenants. They were joined by students, you know, for a massive march of solidarity. Now, we need to go the next stage and not just march and have a picnic and listen to the speeches of our politicians. We need to get down there in big numbers and block and shut down and blockade that port, occupy that port and stop it, just like they did on the West Coast in California a few months ago. We need to start turning Auckland into Oakland.
Yeah. Exactly, and I completely agree. And the slaves are revolting. My very special guest, Joe Carolyn, thank you very much for your time joining
Thanks,
us
Vinny.
The last
Always
minute.
A pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk to you, bro.
Yeah, never a chore, eh? And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in as well. I hope you learned something. I always do. Funny, we always have really cool people on this show, and it's mostly the listeners really that demand that they come on, and the people themselves that come on who just basically keep putting themselves out there. So, you know, basically band together, people, use the resources at your disposal. This show is one of them. If you want me to interview anybody about anything, you give us an email. Just go to the website, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it is the most important question. And we'll see you again sometime, folks.